Something we do 25,000 times a day without thoughts can cause or aggravate a long list of chronic illnesses because we're doing it wrong. 90% of us don't breathe right. And journalist James Nestor counted himself as a bad breather. He suffered from persistent respiratory illness and stress, and a doctor's recommendation to try breathing classes sent him on a journey around the world to learn what so many of us are doing wrong and how to make it right. His new book is called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. And James Nestor joins me now. Hi.
Hi there.
90% is a big number for something we do around 18 times a minute. What are so many of us doing wrong?
Yeah, that was a pretty shocking number when I first heard it a number of years ago. But I think the main thing is that when you are considering how to breathe right, you have to focus on the amount of breaths you're taking per minute and the volume of breath you're taking per minute. And what the vast majority of us are doing is we're breathing too many breaths. We're breathing too often and too much air.
How messed up was your breathing, and what impact was it having on your health?
I was completely messed up. You know, I would like to think of myself as a pretty health conscious person. I was eating the right things. I was exercising a lot, but I was still having constant respiratory problems. And finally, my doctor suggested a breathing class. And that is really what intrigued me, that this subject might be something worth exploring further. It sounded so completely boring to me at the beginning, writing a book about breath. And a bunch of my friends gave me a real hard time about it. But until they saw some of the research and they realized how messed up we are as a species and how just making small little tweaks can really have a transformative effect to our health.
You've discovered that mouth breathing is a huge problem. And you did the mahi, as we call it here in New Zealand. You did the hard work. You took part in what sounds like an awful experiment to show us just how bad it is for our health. What did you do?
Well, about 25 to 50% of the population habitually breathes through the mouth. And it's so widespread now that we don't think that there's really any problem with this until you look at the science and until you talk to the experts in the field. And they told me that mouth breathing can cause all kinds of neurological damage, respiratory damage, can even cause some metabolic problems if we continue to do it on and on, because we're constantly stressing ourselves out by breathing too much through this one channel. So I was talking to the chief of rhinology research at Stanford, and he knew all the problems associated with mouth breathing. He just didn't know how quickly they came on. And I said, well, why don't we test it? He said, how are we going to test it? That would be unethical for me to do such a test because I know the damage it's going to inflict. So I took that as an opportunity to volunteer myself for a test and got one other subject to spend 10 days just mouth breathing. And I know that sounds offensive and awful, but if you look at the population, the huge swath of population already doing this, we were really just lulling ourselves into a position that so many other people already knew.
And what did it do to your body?
Well, we knew it wasn't going to be fun, right? But we didn't know it was going to be as bad as it was. So within a few hours, my blood pressure shot up about 20 points, which was surprising. I thought it might take longer for that to happen. And then that night, I started snoring, and I had not snored before. I thought, oh, this is interesting. I snored for an hour and a half, which is not insignificant. The next night, I was snoring even more. About 4 days in, I was snoring through half the night, and I was choking on myself, something called sleep apnea, where you take in a breath and something about 25% of the U.S. population suffers from this. And it's so damaging. It can lead to Alzheimer's, diabetes, a bunch of other problems. And we were fascinated that just shifting the pathway through which you breathe air could cause such rapid and immediate damage to your bodies.
Into the nose. Which you describe in a quite lovely piece of poetry in the book. You describe our nose as silent warrior, the gatekeeper of our bodies, pharmacist to our minds, and weather vane to our emotions. So, I mean, how does our nose become all of those things?
I know that sounds like a real steep order there, but again, I learned this stuff from the real experts in the field. And I think that all you really need to do is look at the nose, look at its functions, look at how ornate it is. It's called the nasal concha because it's so similar to the shells of mollusks. And mollusks use their shells to keep out invaders, to filter things. And our noses do the same exact thing. When we breathe through the nose, and everyone can do this right now, you are forcing air through this maze. And as it goes through this maze, that air is treated, it's heated, it's humidified, and it's conditioned so that by the time it gets to our lungs can better absorb it more efficiently. So nasal breathing alone will give us about 20% more oxygen than equivalent breaths through the mouth. And through the day, that absolutely adds up.
I mean, I don't want to give a fright to our afternoon listeners, but there are strong connections between our noses and our genitals.
This is true. These are things you don't anticipate finding when you're researching a book on breathing. I'll tell you that much.
Well, your mates would have stopped making fun of you, at least.
Yeah, they did. Now their ears are peeled for the latest little factoid about the nose and the genitals. So no organ is more closely connected to our genitals than our noses. So when one gets excited, the other will respond. And some people have such a close connection that they have this awful affliction called honeymoon rhinitis. When they get sexually attracted, when, you know, the game is on, they start sneezing uncontrollably because their noses engorge with blood, just like other areas of their body. So our noses are covered with erectile tissue, and they respond just like the other parts of our body, and you know what I'm talking about. So it's fascinating, though, that our noses would have this, because they use it to open one nostril and close the other nostril throughout the day. So it's not there randomly. It's there for a reason.
Wow. So we've got that, people listening so far, that where possible you should breathe in and out through your nose. What about when we're exercising?
Breathe through the nose. And I know this is very difficult for people. It was very difficult for me. But if you look at the foundation of science, and people have been studying this for at least 30, 40 years, Dr. John Douyard did some amazing work in the 80s and 90s, looking at when athletes transferred. Instead of transferring that air to the mouth to only inhale through the nose, it was really hard for them. It took them months and months of practice. But once they got it, they were able to work out. They were able to compete at the same level they had before at a lower heart rate. And so by having a lower heart rate, they had lower exertion, which meant that they could push it even harder to go even faster and further than they could before. Because when we're breathing through the nose, we're breathing efficiently. And that especially counts in athletics and in competitions.
We talk to loads of evolutionary biologists on this show. It's our favorite sort of guest. And what we've learned from them is you have the body that works best for your species. And so given that we have all evolved in this world, why are we all breathing wrong? Shouldn't, however we're breathing, however we've evolved to breathe, actually by definition be the best way of breathing?
This was a question that just confounded me for a long time. I said, how can a species evolve a trait that's so detrimental to its health? Because I had always understood that evolution worked in this straight line. Evolution meant progress, you know, survival of the fittest. We're getting better and stronger, natural selection. But that is not what evolution means. Evolution means change, and life can change for the better or the worse. And if you look at the human species, we're changing in so many ways that are deleterious to our health, and our breathing is taking one of the biggest hits. So our mouths have grown so small that our teeth no longer fit. That's why they grow in crooked. And when you have a small mouth, you have a smaller airway, which makes it harder to breathe. And that's one of the reasons why so many of us are suffering from so many chronic respiratory problems, some forms of asthma, sleep apnea, snoring, even allergies. It's because our faces have grown, our mouths specifically have grown so small.
Is that to make room for our giant brains?
It's not. What happened a million years ago, 800,000 years ago, when we invented fire and we were cooking with fire, our brains grew very rapidly because we had all this other energy. We didn't have to sit around and chew all day. So by cooking food, you get more calories. So this allowed our brains to grow larger, and our faces certainly changed during that time. But that change was occurring over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, and our mouths evolved just fine along with that. We could breathe just fine if you're basing that on the skeletal record. But around 300, 400 years ago, when industrialized foods swept the world and we stopped chewing, our mouths grew immediately too small. So within a couple generations, people were having crooked teeth that had never had crooked teeth before. So this isn't something that's just randomly passed down from generation to generation. You can change your mouth, you can change your teeth, and you can change your ability to breathe freely just by not eating proper food. And that's what Weston Price showed, and many other researchers have shown since him.
I'm speaking with journalist James Nestor, whose book is called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. And there's plenty of science in the book, James. You're a man of science. But can I put it to you that some of the ideas on first listen, some of the benefits of breathing, might sound to people a little bit, well, hippy-dippy?
Well, as a science journalist, you know, I would get completely slammed if what I was saying was not firmly supported by facts. So this is one of the reasons on my website there are over 500 scientific references. There are videos. There are x-rays. All of the science that I base this book on is on that site. And it's not my job as a journalist to have an opinion or to want to support one thing or the other. It's my job to go out in the field, talk to the experts in the field, and get the real story. So I understand that some of breathing has been co-opted by hippy-dippy people who don't care too much about the science, and that's fine. They can do whatever they want. They're free to breathe how they want. But again, my job as a journalist is not to wade too deeply in those waters, but to look at the facts and the data. And the great thing about breathing is it's so easy to measure it. And if you can measure it, you can study it, and you can find really how it impacts people.
Nonetheless, some of what doctors and scientists are advising now does hark back to what ancient cultures discovered thousands of years ago.
It certainly does. And that's something, a theme that just kept popping up over and over and over again, is breathing methods and conscious breathing has been around for thousands and thousands of years. It started off in ancient Hindu cultures, and then it went to China. And what I found by comparing these texts is they were all saying the same things over and over. They were just saying it in different languages, and they were calling it by different names. And we've been discovering that same thing in the last century as well. We've been discovering that nasal breathing is very beneficial, that breathing slowly is very beneficial, but we call it these fancy names that, you know, are kind of unnecessary considering that these are really ancient practices. So that's why I called it the new science of a lost art, because in some ways it's been lost from our modern culture. But the science and how this stuff actually works, the impact it has, is been validated time and time again. It absolutely works.
If you've just tuned in, James Nestor is giving us the science on breathing, best ways to breathe, and we've already discussed breathing in and out through your nose when you can. What else would you suggest when it comes to inhaling and exhaling? What else should we be focusing on?
I think the most important thing when it comes to breathing is to become aware of it. We're lucky enough that breathing just kind of runs in the background like a software program, right? We don't have to think about it, and that's a great thing. But when we do think about it, and when we take control of it, we can take control of so many other functions in our body. We can influence our nervous systems. We can influence our immune function. We can actually influence how we think about things, how our brains process things. And again, all of this stuff has been measured time and time again. So awareness is number one. Nasal breathing is very important. Breathing slow and breathing less will actually give you more oxygen more easily. And that seems so counterintuitive, but it's 100% true.
5.5 seconds in, 5.5 seconds out.
Yeah, but don't, you know, I've had a few people emailing me, what if I'm a half a second off? I'm very worried. I'm breathing this way. And this the point of breathing at this pace is about four to six times a minute, 4 to 7 times a minute. That's what has been studied to have been found to be the perfect breath, the most efficient breath for your body to allow you to get the most oxygen, the most easily. So anything in that range of 5 to 6 seconds in, 5 to 6 seconds out is a very balancing breath. And again, there's been 20 years of research into it.
Well, maybe even 20,000 years when you consider, as you discovered, that if you look at some of the major religions, their prayers, their common prayers and chants just happen to be 6 seconds long. It's a good way of keeping time. Om Mane Padme Om.
There you go. You're well versed in these. So that was a discovery about 20 years ago from some Italian researchers. They found that the Catholic prayer cycle of the Rosary, the Ave Maria in Latin, equaled the exact same amount of breaths per minute as Om Mani Padme Hum or Satan Nama, which is a Kundalini chant, or Om. They're all about 5 to 6 seconds to exhale, and when we're exhaling, we're vocalizing, and 5 to 6 seconds to inhale. And so they hypothesized, or rather theorized, that one of the reasons these prayers probably work so well for people, not to take away the religious message, but was because they had them slow down their breathing. And by slowing down their breathing, they were able to get so many of these benefits.
You actually had a major breakthrough with a workshop you did on breathing, right? You describe it in the book. It sounds quite an incredible experience.
Yeah, it's a very weird experience, especially for a journalist, and I didn't know what to do with it. So this was at the time when I was suffering from a bunch of different respiratory issues, and I went to this class. In San Francisco, there's breathing classes all over the place. You know, you can't throw a rock and hit 5 different breathing sessions run by different people. So I was pretty apprehensive, but This was coming from my doctor. You know, she was really smart, and I said, okay, what do I have to lose? And I walked into this room and crossed my legs and started breathing at this rhythmic pattern. Nothing really major, just sort of. And I started sweating a sweat I've never experienced in my life, even when working out really intensely. My hair was sopping wet. I completely sweated through my T-shirt, sweated through parts of my jeans. It was just insane. And I asked my doctor, I said, what had happened? You know, you should know what happens. You're a doctor. You've studied this stuff. And she had no idea. So, you know, I didn't want to write a memoir about breathing. So I filed that experience in the back of my mind for a number of years until I started really talking to people who study breathing and showed me what I experienced was just the tip of the iceberg for this stuff. I interviewed people who were able to sit in ice and for 2 hours at a time and not have their core temperature go down, or people who were able to breathe in ways to fight off E. coli. They were injected with E. coli and they could fight off that endotoxin just by breathing. So it just shows you this window into human potential that we're just really finding our way through.
Mm. You also talk about the benefits of humming. That's something that people could do maybe when they're alone.
You could do it around other people. You'll annoy the hell out of them, likely. But by humming, you increase your nitric oxide about 15-fold. Now, nitric oxide is this molecule. It's produced throughout the body, but we produce a profusion of it in our sinus cavities, our sinus passages. And it turns out that nitric oxide is the molecule that is released when people take Viagra or other drugs. What allows Viagra to do its wonders is it releases nitric oxide in the body, because nitric oxide is a vasodilator. It improves circulation throughout the body. So we can produce our own nitric oxide in our noses, and it also turns out that nitric oxide is one of the first lines of defense for our body. It interacts directly with bacteria, with viruses, and pathogens to kill them before they enter into our bodies. So breathing through the mouth, you get none of those benefits, but breathing through the nose and humming, you can really increase your nitric oxide and bolster your immune functions.
And if you do it with the mask on, no one knows who's humming.
That's exactly right. And if you hum a song everyone likes, maybe they'll start humming along with you.
Hey, someone in the office wanted me to ask, does breathing into a paper bag help for anxiety attacks?
So there's mixed research on this. The researchers I talked to said, do not do that. And the reason is because some people may not be suffering from anxiety attacks. They may be suffering from heart attacks. And if you have them breathe into a bag, you could kill them. So for people who know they have anxiety, a much better method is to slow down your breathing, not to breathe too much. Breathe at that rate of 6 breaths, 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out. There was a huge research study of panic sufferers. They had them do this. Within 2 weeks, 40% of them had no panic attacks. A year after that study, something like 90% of them were not having panic attacks anymore by just slowing down their breathing. So from them, I would say the advice that I heard was you can ditch the paper bag, use your own body, use your own lungs to take control of your breathing and really take control of so much of your health.
And breathing is unconscious and automatic. So does paying attention to your breathing when you think about it and doing some practice of humming and 5.5 seconds in, 5.5 seconds out, does that actually have any real impact if you're only doing it for a sort of a practice session once a day at best?
Yes, it does. And if you look at the work by Dr. Richard Brown and Dr. Patricia Gerbarg, he is at Columbia University, a very respected institution out here in the States. They found that even a few minutes of doing this really helped people with anxiety. They've used it for people with depression. They've used it for 9/11 sufferers who had lung damage. So obviously it's better to breathe well all the time, but it's all about baby steps. So for a lot of people, that's going to seem too long. Then you can speed it up a bit, you know, make it a 7 breaths a minute and slowly acclimate your body. Because what you're doing is you're not so much slowing your body down. You're not breathing less air. You're breathing the right amount of air. You're reconditioning us to breathe the way that we are designed to breathe. And that's really what it's all about.
What changed for you when your breathing changed?
Well, writing a book about breathing makes you complete neurotic. You know, you start paying attention to your breathing all the time. Yeah. And I am not the best breather in the world. Yeah, I interviewed the best breathers in the world and some of the best scientists in this field. But people look to me some people have said, oh, you know everything about your breathing must be perfect. I'm still on this journey, right? I'm trying to improve it as much as I can. But I did notice how aware I am of it all the time, for better or for worse. I'm aware of it, especially when working out, especially when I'm stressed. And just to take that moment to reset yourself, to take control of our breath. You know, we can't control our autonomic nervous system with our minds. We can't control our liver function or our stomachs or our hearts. But when we take control of breathing, we can influence all of these functions. We can really change how our bodies operate. So that to me has been the biggest thing. And just to watch after a minute and a half of breathing a certain way, I can drop my blood pressure by 10 points. And other people can drop it by even more. So this is not a placebo effect. This is allowing your body to really function in the way that it was designed to function.
You mentioned snoring before. Can it help with snoring?
Absolutely. So there's a bunch of great research right now teaching people how to exercise their tongues. And I know this seems a little wacky, but this study was released in Chest, a very, very well-respected journal. And so if you think about the throat, it is a muscle tube, right? So if you're just eating soft, crappy, industrialized foods all day, you're not exercising the muscles in your mouth. And they really want to be exercised to work properly, just like anything else. So by just doing some simple exercises with your tongue, you can start some fitness in your mouth. And by doing that, they showed that people had a tremendous benefit to sleep apnea and snoring. And also, as I've found, you know, breathing through the nose at night is imperative. You have to find a way of doing that. And one way of doing that I was told at Stanford is to put that little piece of tape on your lips to try to train your jaw shut at night. And I found that I wake up so much more energized. And I've even measured my oxygen throughout the night and found I get way more oxygen just breathing through the nose.
Good little trick. Stop snoring. Stop sleeping like a slack-jawed yokel, huh?
And just to be clear, this isn't going to cure everybody of everything. For mild or moderate snoring and sleep apnea, it's been shown to have a very transformative effect for a lot of people. And the best part about it, it's free. So why not give it a go?
And as you say in your book, what's the worst that can happen?
The worst that can happen is you can feel better. That's about the greatest, you know, the most injurious side effect of all this stuff.
Great. Well done on the book. It's called Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. And I've been speaking to James Nestor. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.